Welcome to Fresh from the Pod. My name is Tamsin Westhorpe, and in this episode, I talk to horticulturist Chris Collins of Blue Peter Gardener Fame. Being a well-known TV gardener is just a very small part of his fascinating horticultural journey. Join me as I hear about his time gardening in Japan, Cameroon, the Royal Botanic Gardens Kew, and being head gardener of none other than Westminster Abbey. He has so much to be proud of, and I don't mind admitting that I'm rather jealous of all that he's achieved. Well, Chris, I am so thrilled that you've joined me on Fresh from the Pod. I've seen you at many events. We've briefly chatted, and you're very lucky that there were lots of other people there because I have so many questions. I would have collared you for hours. Your career is quite spectacular. And you're known to a lot of us because you were the Blue Peter Gardener, but that's just a tiny bit of your life, isn't it?
Well, yes, thanks for inviting me first, Tamsin. I'm very proud to be part of this. I really enjoy the podcast. And if you had collared me, I'm sure we'd have been talking about plants for hours, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm sure
you would have done. Yeah, you're right. And it's strange, you know, I was listening to a previous podcast of yours, listening to you talk about to Toby Buckland, and it's funny, when you do telly, you become defined by it. Because that's how people know you. That's not a bad thing, I don't think. You know, that's not a bad thing. But there is all this other stuff that goes on to get you to that position, and all the stuff that kind of bounces off the back of it as well, obviously, because I've done a tremendous amount of work with schools and children since my Blue Peter days. But I have been very lucky in my career. I've taken my chances, and I've been at some wonderful places in the world as well, and that's been very important to me.
And we've got something in common. I was thrilled to see that you started your career as an apprentice for Brighton Parks Department.
That's right.
And I started mine as an apprentice for Bournemouth Parks Department.
Just up the road.
Yeah, exactly. So coastal. But explain to me, did you grow up in London?
No, I'm a Brighton. Well, actually, it's very confusing. I'm born in the Midlands. I'm actually a Brummie. Started in a Aston Villa fan, to be fair. So I had quite a nervous day yesterday. But due to the demographics of divorce, etc., I moved around. I lived in Newcastle. I lived in Leeds when I was a kid. I was all over the shop. We then settled in Brighton. And a true East Ender will tell you this isn't a London accent. They'll get that straight away. Although it probably sounds like it to most people.
It does.
So I grew up. Yeah, I know. I tell you, if I go to the Bow Bells and I start chatting in a pub, they will pick up I am not a Londoner straight away. But you need to be in that niche to get that.
Our industry, you are, like, I would say, the Londoner. Isn't that strange?
The garden geezer, yeah, isn't it?
Yeah,
because
exactly.
the reason for it is as simple. I'm from a big a council estate called Molescombe, just outside Brighton, where there's a big school called Falmer School, and they were mainly filled by relocated Londoners after the war. So there's kind of a connection between London there. That's why I don't sound like I'm from Portsmouth. Basically, that's the difference between, yeah. But Brighton Parks was an amazing parks department. I would say it still is now. Any park is brilliant, but I was very fortunate to train on there. It was a proper 5-year apprenticeship. They moved you around. I did, you know, down the pavilion. I looked after tropical collections for 6 months on big bedding, big groundsmanship. I really think I couldn't have got a more healthier start to my career as a gardener. I don't know if you agree with that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think I was probably the first female parks gardener in Bournemouth. I learned so much, and I was so physically fit as well. And you learn the traditional things like turf and bedding. And I noticed you've got on your Instagram, you've got your amazing balcony garden. And to me, it's quite, I love bedding plants, and you use them a lot, don't you now?
I do. I kind of feel like, are we out of date because of that? Do you think?
I know, I don't.
It's not so trendy now. It's not so popular. Obviously, it's quite intense horticulture. But the balcony, I used to work in Tokyo, so all the gardens I built were in balconies outside. But I think there's a very personal relationship between you and that balcony. And because it's a small space, you go for maximum effect. So basically I'm going to have a glut of tomatoes any minute. So there I've got a tumbler of tomatoes mixed in with a bedding. So I potage it quite heavily, but it's the colour I love. It's that kind of bright, you know, full on, right, come on, let's smile, get up and smile sort of colour, really.
No, well, look, the listener can't hear, but I've got very untrendy gladioli behind me in a vase. So,
what is,
you know.
This is such a brilliant flower, isn't it? And it's so funny how things, I suppose the problem is as we sort of, there's this trend in more natural gardening, more freer gardening about letting each, which is not a bad thing. Then maybe, you know, the blousy flowers and the bedding has been taken a bit of a step back. But it's also, it's economics, because most parks haven't got money, and then so no, you've seen a decrease. And it, speaking of the gardeners, I mean, I remember, funny you should say you're the only woman on Bournemouth Parks, because it was a white geezer's game when I joined the parks.
Yeah.
You know, and their fathers did it, and their sons did it, and it was down the line. They probably got a Thai cottage. But from my point of view, to be honest, 30 years later, I've never met gardeners as good as that in terms of the actual practical ability to
No,
to
I
garden.
Agree.
Yeah.
And working out all year, every weather.
Yes.
You know, real tough, really, really tough group of people. So how did you get from school to being there? What was the sort of seed that you thought, I'm going to be a horticulturalist?
Well, it was, I mean, it's an interesting story, and it kind of sticks with me today quite clearly. I came from a very dark place to be in a gardener. So I was thrown out when I was 16. There were, you know, there was stuff going on that wasn't good. I was not heading in the right direction. And I had a very negative, everything was negative at that point. I remember this very clearly. And I knew that if I didn't do something, I'd be in trouble. And so I used to grow a lot of houseplants in my bedroom. I still do now. I mean, my flat is half jungle, half flat. And much to my, probably drives my missus a bit mad, but we, there you go. But I remember going for an apprenticeship, and all I said to them is I want to be outside. I remember being at school and fidgety and all that. I want to be outside. And they put me in for Brighton Parks. And I remember very clearly the first 2 weeks I planted a Cornish elm, almost Placerica augustifolia. We dug out the root ball. We put this new one in, and I just knew. I don't know if, I'm not a big believer in epiphanies, but I just knew that's what I wanted to do. So it was like dark, light and dark, if you like. I came from this quite severe place into just the love of plants, really. And that tree, I sat in it doing a programme for the BBC like 25 years later, and you just, that kind of sums it up, doesn't it, really? That longevity, that relationship you have with nature and plants, is being a gardener really brings you close to it.
I mean, you can't say you've achieved anything better, really, than planting that tree. I mean, it's quite incredible
I've got a feeling that... It's true. I've got a feeling that I will, when I'm down in Brighton, because I've still got my brother lives there, my mates are all there, I am known to give it a cuddle, like in the afternoon, especially after a few ciders. I will go along and see it. But I just know it'll be there while I'm around and probably long after. So there's a very personal, you know, underlying statement, especially when, from the situation I'd been in previously to becoming a gardener.
To that, yeah. I mean, I planted some little pine trees in Bournemouth along the seafront, and they were only about 8 inches, and I must have been sort of 18. And I remember digging in the sandy soil and boiling hot, thinking, these are never going to come to anything. It's a waste of time. And now I drive along that road, and they are enormous. It makes you feel a bit old, though. That's the only thing.
It does. We can't get around that. But you're right, there's that. Whatever else you do, so you can go on to be the Blue Peter gardener or whatever you do, is the core feeling of being a gardener is kind of summarised in that feeling, isn't it, of looking at something you've planted or something. I remember, it's funny you say about you're harding up on the parks. I remember very clearly pruning berberis in December on the parks, freezing cold, I mean windy, cold. But I kind of feel that's where I spiritually connected with being a gardener. I think you need to be in that scenario to reach that place. You don't learn it in a classroom. You don't learn it, or, you know, you don't get it through a design. I don't think you kind of get it, that feeling of you and the wind on your face and the low winter sun. I think you kind of connect with it spiritually. And maybe that makes me sound like a bit of a hippie, but I can't.
Well, no, but I think it's the reality of the job. You know, it's no good coming straight in as a TV presenter and never having gone through all those things. But, I mean, you went on to work in Cameroon. I mean, what?
Yeah, I know. That was just amazing. Well, it's an interesting story as well, because I went on, when you finish the parks, I went to do my diploma at Edinburgh Botanics, and it's like the road widens out, for want of an expression. So you discover this... What is horticulture is international, and the British are very well renowned in it. And so you kind of discover this whole network all over the world. So there was a big project going on in Cameroon. It's a mouthful. This is the Mount Cameroon International Conservation Genetic Conservation Project or something like that. It's a big old sentence. And I got a chance to do a dissertation on it in 92. So I went to do that dissertation. I was there about 6 weeks. And then they offered me an internship at the end of my diploma. So I then went for 6, 7, 8 months or something. And but that was just incredible. We used to live with chimpanzees. So I'd go out for breakfast in the morning. And I'd have a chimp. Well, I cooked my breakfast. A chimp stuck to my calf, a baby. I shared a room with an 8-month-old chimp called Mercy for 4 months. And you're just in this entirely different world. And we did a lot of rainforest inventory work. So we would go, I mean, out. I remember going to a Kurup, places like that, where you're 7 hours in a Land Rover and you just expect a dinosaur to run past you. It's just the back of beyond, but just incredibly beautiful. And we used to go up to Mount Cameroon, we'd collect plants. So I would hook myself into a tree and drop down on a cliff face and collect begonias and this sort of stuff. You were right in there. You really were quite incredible.
And when you were doing that, did you sort of have flashbacks to your past where things were a bit darker and think, how the hell did I end up in a rainforest tree?
I think I still do that now, to be honest with you. I think that always stays with you, that experience. I think that it kind of creates who you are. And again, that expression of like night and day, coming from one place to another, that's still strong. So yeah, certainly. What I really felt most of all is, you know, I started off strimming verges and getting covered in dog poo all that time before. And now I'm like in a rainforest 70 miles from the nearest running electricity, looking at the Milky Way. So I felt like I'd taken my chances, Tamsin, you know what I mean? That's how it felt. I felt like it was a sense of achievement and just wonder, really.
Yeah. And do you find in life, I mean, I'm one of these people that I say yes to most things, and your path is, you just suddenly have an opportunity that you think, blimey, you would never dream of that, and you go with it. You strike me as someone that probably just goes with things. Am I right?
Absolutely. I think that in life, sometimes the window, it just chinks open a bit and you make a decision then, don't you? You go, well, I can sit here. This is my square. I've got all this going on, or I'll just go bolt. I'll go through it. And that's what happened. That's what happened when I went to Cameroon. It certainly happened when I went to Japan, is that opportunities present, and certainly with the telly as well, opportunities present themselves and you make a choice. Well, I'll go in. If I don't like it, I'll come out again. There's nothing to lose, but I'll always have a pop, always.
So in Japan, were you teaching people British English ways of horticulture, or what were you up to there?
Well, this was a crazy story because I came back to Edinburgh after Africa, and I went back to Edinburgh, which is where I was living, obviously, and studying before I went to Africa. And I sit in a bar called the Barony Bar in Broughton, my old local on Broughton Street. And I was sitting there having a beer, and someone came in with a newspaper and had a little tiny advert in it. It said gardeners wanted in Tokyo. So I thought, I'll have a little go at this. So I whacked the CV off, and literally 6 weeks later, I was sitting on an aeroplane going to Tokyo. And I remember thinking to myself, right, Japan. I'm going, what do I know about Japan? Absolutely nothing at all.
No. Nothing. And how many pints had you had when you read that?
I'd had a few. Yeah, I'd had a few. And so it just all kind of unfolded like that whole thing about, I'm just in for a penny, in for a pound. But this gets more bizarre, this story, because I went to Tokyo and I was first, you'll know them, I was first working for a Barakura English Garden out in the mountains in the garden.
Yeah, I've been there. Yeah. I was going to say
so
to
you. Yeah, so
you
know it. Yeah, out, it's very beautiful mountains. But I was there 2 weeks and I was kind of thinking, oh, I don't know about being trapped here. But then they subbed me out to a big department store called Mitsukoshi in Tokyo. And really, this is where the fun began for me, because I literally got to a brand new shop. It was the biggest land development in Tokyo for 30 years or something. A company called Sapporo were famous for beer. And I got to this shop. The lifts were still in bubble wrap. It was just unbelievable, this place. A big place called Ebisu Garden Place. And then they said, put me in the shop. And they went, right, this is your, you know, this is where you're working. And I was thinking, what am I going to do here? So I kind of built the job. We did import, export. We did, the Japanese are massive on gifts, as you'd know. So we were doing lots of containers for gifts, selling those, doing design, building roof gardens. We just built this whole thing up. And it was just, the bad, bizarrest thing, I was the only gaijin, the only foreigner in the whole shop. So it was me and 500 Japanese people. So can you imagine how surreal that must have been? It just was. Yeah. It's your eccentricity, just mine. Anyway, just climbed to the surface. And one of my favourite stories is they call you gaijin, and I've been there about 6 weeks, and they started calling me henna gaijin, so gaijin means alien in straight translation. Henna gaijin means strange alien. So I'd actually managed to double it up just because he's just like, just such a different kind of character to who they were, you know?
But I went to Barracura, oh gosh, 10 years ago now. And like you say, it's a complete culture shock, isn't it? And I had to do demonstrations and things. And they, like you said, they give you gifts. The people that were watching at the end of the week, they gave me gifts. And my suitcase, when I got to the airport to go home, it was so overweight, I had to leave some of my clothes. I had to actually bin some of my clothes to get my gifts back to the UK. Absolute madness. But what I found fascinating... Go on.
I was going to say, they're not worthless gifts even, are they? They're useful stuff. They think about it, you know, they really do.
Exactly. That's why I thought, well, I've got to throw my clothes away and go home with all these books and lovely little mirrors and all sorts. But, I mean, what struck me was the very different way that they garden there. I was doing container demonstrations and they were literally cramming. I couldn't get them to space their plants out. No, it was all about the picture and the moment. Did you find that?
Well, it's like almost like flower arranging, and so you would, it's about the presentation. So what they see a container as is something you gift to someone else. So if you're going to go to dinner at a friend's house or a relative's house, you would take one of these containers as a gift. So it's not necessarily seen as a permanent fixture. So like that's so the only time that ever changed was when I got into designing balconies and roofs, because then you could start to develop sort of some more longevity to the garden and the space. But any kind of container was, I don't think they saw it any differently as than a bunch of flowers, really. So you ram it in and you make it look good. It's not there to be look nice in a month's time or 2 months' time. And actually, the whole gardening thing there, I think one of the reasons for that is they have a different perception of gardening. So if they see a container, they see it as something quite Western, quite different, whereas their gardens are more reflective. And I found out most, because, you know, I'm married to a Japanese girl, so I caught her towards the end. And when I found out most about Japanese gardens, when I went south to Kyushu, where she's from, and you have these amazing suburban gardens, and you knock the door, and they open the door. They're amazing people, a little bit, and they go, and they look nervous at first. And my wife would say, oh, this is my husband. He was trained at Edinburgh, worked at Kew. And then you'd end up staying for dinner there, and they'd explain the garden. It was all about how it was to be contemplated. So you put rocks in certain places, plants in gravel. The gravel's the sea, the rocks are the mountains, the plants are the forest. Whereas when we garden, is I want this here, I want red over here, this is my garden, I want to sow this, I want... So it's a kind of the ways that we both garden are really pole, almost similar to the two societies and the nature of the people, very poles apart, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. But how is your Japanese then?
It's awful.
So you relied on your wife then?
Well, I can kind of get by, but this is a really strange thing to say, but when you're working in a shop for 500 people, I quite enjoyed not knowing what was going on. It was actually incredibly liberating. It was, because otherwise you're worried about politics and you're worried about this and you're worried about, and there was this kind of freedom, this liberty to just kind of being outside that bubble. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And I quite enjoyed that. But I kind of speak bits of Japanese. I can certainly hear it a lot. But my wife would tell you that I'm useless.
But what I found strange is I had a translator when I was doing my talks, and you'd say something that wasn't funny, and then she'd translate it and they'd be laughing. And you think, oh, God, what did she translate? You know, it's quite fascinating. But, I mean, I think what you've obviously brought back and learnt is this balcony, is this gardening on a small, tight space. So when you were in Tokyo creating these gardens and advising people, what was the sort of challenges that you faced?
Well, some of them were certainly plant choice. I remember very clearly, because I would get asked to do a garden 2 metres long, 1 metre wide, 10 stories up, which is how a lot of people live in Tokyo. So you kind of, whoa. So you needed to go through a process of learning what would burn out, you know, that kind of. So a lot of things like leptospermums, a lot of Southern Hemisphere plants were okay. Old English roses. I was the first man to import David Rose, Austin Roses into Japan, along with Barracura. And he's got nurseries everywhere. I feel like he owes me something for that. But I remember bringing them in. We charged 80 quid a rose and they sold immediately. But we were using them, things like Albertine, these kind of old roses, high up on balconies, and they took it. They would grow fine. And then you kind of like, the very concept of a balcony is you look at it and you think, well, I'm going to get much on that. But as soon as you start whacking hanging baskets on the railings, the walls, filling them out with seasonal, with some backbone planting like herbs and roses, you can really get something going. You really can.
And I think that is what we need to do more of in the UK, isn't it? With smaller homes, tighter spaces. So you're the man. You've got the experience.
If they want to contact me, no problem. And you figure exactly. A city like London, only half the population now have a garden because we all live in flats. So I love London, but one of the sacrifices I make for being in London is I'm on the third floor. So that's, you know, because it's expensive to be here. The chances of me going out and buying a terraced house with a 100-foot back garden are nil. So you've got to adapt to that scenario, I suppose.
But you've got an allotment, haven't you?
I have. I love that allotment so much. You know what? I go down there and in the early evening, there's no one there. I'm in a city of 10 million people. How often do you get to be by yourself? And suddenly you're on this allotment, you and the birds. Sometimes I'll whack the reggae on the headphones, have a little skank while I'm working. Nobody notices. It's just an oasis, that place. It really is.
And did you have to wait forever for an allotment plot in London?
This is going to make you sick, but I got it in 3 weeks after moving to Enfield.
Really?
Seriously. Yeah, I went online. I said, I want an allotment. They contacted me 2 weeks later. Come and have a look. They gave me the worst one they could find because obviously I was being cocky and naming stuff.
Yeah.
They gave me the worst one they could find and they gave it to me on the spot. And it's still a lot of work now, weed-wise especially, but I think they're special places, allotments. And like this week, it was just the time, isn't it? We're eating fresh vegetables every night, and I just the difference in taste between that and what I buy at a supermarket. I mean, there isn't a comparison.
Oh, amazing. So then you end up being the face of Blue Peter Gardening, which, you know, when was it?
2014, I started. 2004, Gosh. Sorry. 2004, yeah. And I finished it. I nearly did it for a decade, just shy of a decade, actually. Blue Peter was, to be honest with you, it's the only part of telly I really enjoyed. I did The Plantsman, that started me off. And I did all this morning, all this stuff. And, you know, I always felt like I was punching above my weight with it, to be honest with you. And it's a strange game, television. It's not anything. It's nothing like gardening. It just isn't at all, is it? But you kind of roll with it. But I have to say, when I joined Blue Peter, I just enjoyed every minute of that because you kind of opened up this avenue of talking to the next generation, I suppose, if you like. And it kind of triggered all this other work I've done in the last 12, 13 years, which is, I mean, I remember in 2017, I did 280 schools in 1 year. So you just had all this other stuff built off the back of it, which was just incredibly good fun, really good fun. Then I got to be Father Christmas, a Buddhist monk. What else? They was always dressing me up. It was great. I mean, they were always putting me in clothes and false beards on me. And it was just a good laugh.
I hope you've got a Blue Peter badge for all that.
I've got a few, to be fair.
I'm glad to hear that. But how did it work? Did you decide what content was going to be on the show, or was it quite structured with the team? How did that work?
I mean, it was, when I first joined, the reason I loved it was because I would drive it, almost direct it to certain certain levels, you know, because they didn't know anything about gardening, it was handed to me. So as long as it fitted into a 3-4 minute slot and it was visible and interesting and lively, I kind of got to dictate it to a certain degree. And obviously it's a big team effort. So part of, I think, telly being successful is the people you work around. If you have a good relationship with them, then it really works. If you don't, it kind of bombs the other way. And I think that kind of, so I would come up with ideas and they would obviously sit in editorials and go, well, that we can make that work. So a lot of it was based around the garden at first, but then we were going out and satelliting and traveling and stuff. And so it was definitely, I was respected as the gardener is, I suppose, a good way to describe it.
Which is quite a lovely position to be in, isn't it? To be able to put your spin, you're not just script reading and following instruction. Who were the presenters when you were there?
Well, I did loads of work with Connie Huck. That was kind of, me and Connie did a lot together. I did a lot with Matt Baker, and then it went on as times changed. Helen Skelton was the one I did a load of work with towards the end, and I finished off working with Barney, because the last thing I ever did for Blue Peter was I literally dug the garden up and moved it to Manchester. And I numbered it like a giant jigsaw, the sunken garden, and moved it to Manchester. We did it in February. When Percy Thrower built it originally, he took 9 men 3 months to build it. I dug it up, moved it, rebuilt it, made a 10-minute film with two guys in 9 days.
Excellent. There's
it's just another world, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But what was your sort of funniest memory from doing that? Did anything go disastrously wrong?
Well, I have got a few. I mean, usually my clangers, to be honest with you, because I'm known to drop them. And I remember one time I put these sunflowers in. They had this big thing about sunflowers. And I went in one day on a... I always used to go on a Sunday. It was amazing. So you go into the TV centre, be hardly anyone there. So I'd do a few hours gardening and then go and watch the football in the... on the bar in the fourth floor. So it's just, you'd have the place to yourself. It's quite surreal. But I put all these sunflowers in and I went in one Sunday and I thought, they look a bit ropey. So I cut them all down and they were an essential part of a live show the following day. So it was, as far as clangers go, it was a pretty good one, I would say. And then that's in CCTV footage and all this sort of stuff. And I learned a lesson that day. Also, when we moved, they asked me to dig up the, the pods they used to put the time caps. Capsules. They asked me to dig that up, and so I said, "Where is it?" They said, "Over in the corner." And I literally dug a hole as tall as 6 foot deep and 4 foot wide, and I still couldn't find this thing. So it's just huge molehill of soil. Yeah, it's hilarious. In the end, I had to get a JCB and a little digger to get it out.
They found them and reburied.
Yeah, I know. I know where it is now because I reburied it, so I know where it is. It's one of the secrets I'll be taking to my grave.
Yeah, that is hilarious. So when will they dig those up again? Are they just going to leave them?
Well, I presume so. I think they dig one up, didn't they? Dig one up 10 years ago that kind of reached its point of being dug up. But obviously I'm not part of it now, so I don't know that. And to me, the big thing about Blue Peter is what it propelled me into, because that was all the stuff I've done in schools. That's kind of been... I felt like I put something back. I had this amazing sort of career and it felt like I was returning something. And you have such a laugh with the children, you really do.
So what, I mean, I'm constantly trying to get my son to garden. He's a teenager now and I've tried incredibly hard. I don't know if I've achieved anything or not. But what would you, what are the sort of best ways for parents and guardians to get kids interested? And really, from your point of view, older kids, teenagers.
Well,
is it possible?
I think the teenagers and secondary schools are the great frontier. And I don't really know until two things need to happen for that change. One is that you need to be paid more money as a gardener if you're going to go into it. And because they're looking at career, they're looking at all this sort of stuff. You have to do that. But the other thing is we need to sing the gardener up more. We take a bit of a back seat, don't we? If you look at the way it's filmed on the shows, it's about the design, it's about the flamboyance. I'm not criticising that, but I kind of think the person that comes on after and makes it happen, who does the magic, really, who can grow the plants, propagate the plants, take things out, move things about, we don't really get the press we deserve in many ways. And especially from a teenager, they'll kind of, I think they see that it's quite tedious, whereas actually me and you know it's the most magical part of it in many ways. With a primary, it's easy because they'll just... I mean, you can tell them the moon's made of cheese and they'll get into it. In fact, when I speak to schools, I always do an assembly at the start and I put up 30 ideas. I do a little bit on Cameroon, a bit on Japan, ideas in the garden, things like pizza wheels and edible hanging baskets. But I'm talking to the teacher just as much as I'm talking to the children, because if I convince the teacher this is good, then the kids will be able, they'll give time to it, they'll give effort to it, and they'll set up gardening clubs. So my conversation is just as fully directed as the adult, to encourage the adult, is the kid, because they need to donate time to it, basically. And it works. I've been out in schools with kids in the pee rain. We're all covered in mud, doing stuff in the garden. They don't mind. They don't care. I must be the bane of many a mother's life when they got in with the state of their clobber. But that's the whole idea, is in creating that enthusiasm.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, I don't know, I suppose we've got computer games to blame a lot as well with teenagers, so much
I think,
more fun, apparently.
Yeah, but they're affluent, aren't they? They've kind of like, we live in quite a wealthy country. I'm not saying that's for everyone. I don't let me play down people who've got issues with poverty and stuff. But when I was a kid, I climbed trees. If I was a kid now, I probably wouldn't be doing that. I would be, like you say, on a computer. So it's kind of... In a little way, we've got to kind of we're kind of reattaching them to nature in many ways, and that's the point of teaching them gardening. The other thing, and this is the reason it all started, is child health. I got involved with it through things like the school food plan, through David Dimbleby's the Leon brothers, you know, the restaurant Leon, through School Food Matters, Trees for Cities, now at the moment there's Veg Power. All these people came together as quite a huge movement to talk about child obesity, healthy eating, and that those all those worlds connect together. And that's where gardening had an in schools, in primary schools.
I mean, I've noticed that I've grown a lot more edibles during this strange time we've had. And at the beginning of it, my son would not have touched spinach. Absolutely no way. But now he's eating everything we grow because we've grown it. I'm sending him out to pick it. He's eating spinach. He goes, oh, I quite like that. So it's a case of if you've grown it, I think you're more likely to eat it, aren't you?
I think gardening is a hands-on thing, isn't it? I think that if you someone was sat there and you went, do you fancy planting a tree or growing some spinach? They'd think, Teddy's on, you know. But as soon as you know what it's like, as soon as you're out there and your hands are in the soil, and that's the thing I've noticed with children, actually, is I've never had a kid who's knocked it back. It's so natural to put our hands in the soil. It is a practice. It's, you know, it's what to garden is to do it, isn't it, really? Does that make sense?
Yeah, and really, it's in us. It's our survival. You know, that's how we, you know, exist, isn't it?
For thousands of years, we were farmers and gardeners. So it's got to be inside us, isn't it, really? We've only been going to supermarkets since the end of the war, haven't we, really? So it's a fairly new development.
Now, I wanted to obviously ask you about your time as gardener at Westminster Abbey.
It probably stands out as... you know, the top one in terms of surreal. It was quite a surreal environment. You go to work and I remember the third day I was there, I walked through the cloisters and Margaret Thatcher walked past me. That's the kind of place it was. Yeah, that's the kind of place it was. And you were just like, what? I remember going and protesting against her in the 80s.
I know, how bizarre.
And then I remember just like things like the Queen, where the Queen Mother used to be there quite a lot. She's come out into the garden quite a bit. They'd have these garden parties and the great and the good, the politicians. We were just kind of in that. We used to go to a thing called Jerusalem Chamber, which is this incredible chamber at Jerusalem Chamber. And we'd have, as a head of department, I'd be invited. And you'd sit and you'd eat with, there'd be all the knife and forks laid out, like a big row of them for each course. They were solid gold. And there'd be like priceless crystal, you'd be drinking your wine out. They used to count it in and out. And I used to think, well, that's not for me. But then I sat next to so many politicians, I thought, it can't be. And then you'd be like priceless Botticellis on the wall and this sort of stuff. So you were just kind of, I suppose, in the seat of the establishment in many ways. That's the best, only way I can think to describe it. And so it was very surreal. And then, but I did some good gardening there. I'm very proud. It was not in good nick, that garden. We really kicked it on, me and my friend Cormac, two of us, and they were, Jan was another one as well. She worked part time, and we did a lot of good stuff there. And I'm very proud of that. So it wasn't just being Westminster Abbey. We did some useful gardening there.
So you arrive at work, and it's just you're surrounded by, you know, the tombs of kings and queens.
Yes,
and
yes,
it's just this. It's the biggest historic giant you could be playing with, really. Yeah. And did that worry you that, you know, obviously if you're implementing new planting, was that quite terrifying?
Well, what happens was, I mean, you're right about, I mean, like, my boss, you know, whatever, how many hundreds of years ago, would have been Chaucer, clerk at the works. That's what sort
it's
of place
crazy.
It is. Yeah. And you'd go in and you'd see Edward the Confessor obviously built it, and then where he is, where his coffin is, you'd see the stone would be worn where all the pilgrims had visited him. Like, there'd be knee grooves where, just little touches like that. But I used to go very early in the morning, and when there's nobody there, my philosophy as a gardener is start early, finish early, so I don't have to do rush hour on the tubes. That's kind of how I do it. So you'd walk there in the morning, the choir would be practicing. It's just the most amazing. I'm not a religious man, but you just can't feel help being bowled away by the sound of this choir. But the garden was a mess, so I set about it. And this is my philosophy, is I know over time, people more powerful me in that setup would have started to rein me in. So I had to be on my toes. So I was building compost bins and replanting and doing the lawn. I used to cut the lawn in circles with a 27-inch mower with a nap. I'd walk 11 miles on one cut of a morning doing that. So you just got to make this impact straight away. And then people, because a lot of residents there, people would start to go, wow, this is amazing. But you do get your wings clipped eventually as other people move in on it, if that makes sense.
So I've never been to this garden. I've been to a service, actually, in Westminster Abbey. But how can you, when you visit the Abbey, can you go into the garden?
Yeah, you don't need to go into the Abbey to visit the garden. you just go through the cloisters and it's open Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays. Obviously not at the moment because we're in this strange scenario, but normally. So, you know, it's a good kept secret in a way. But you, if you want to, like, cut the sandwich, you're in central London, it's a nice place to go and sit. It really is.
Gosh, but it's just like you've turned the soil where all these ridiculously famous people have walked. And I wondered, you know, you said that you went early, but were you ever there after dark? Because I thought, oh, that'd be so spooky, wouldn't it?
Well, it is, but it is. Well, I used to do, because between sort of June and July or August, they put up a marquee, so everybody parties there. You know, there's like all the great and the good come, and you know, the big corporate organisations like Morrison's, I used to do a lot of stuff for them. I met them there. And you kind of say, I would be there, then I'd have to close it down after they all left, like at night in the dark underneath Victoria Tower. And yeah, so it's really, really quite surreal. Nothing about that job wasn't surreal. That's the, if I had to come up with one word, that would be it. It really would.
And how long did you do that for?
I did that for about 3.5 years, and then I quit that to do the plants run. That's when all the telly stuff started. That sort of came in, and then I and that's when I left.
Yeah. Gosh, you can't really beat that, can you?
Yeah, it's a mad one. I've got a beautiful talk on it. I'll come and do it for you someday. I've got, because if we just started from scratch, we had big Prunus loris cereus in the borders. Not even weeds were growing. No one had composted the soil for years. It was kind of really run down. And so I went in, I mean, it's just me all over. It was something to get my teeth right into. And I enjoyed it very much. Very, very much. And obviously, I popped back Cormac, my deputy, still works there. So I have a beer with him sometimes. And some of the plants I put in are still there. So I still have that relationship with it.
That's quite incredible. Gosh, that really is. Now, you then went on, I'm probably getting this totally in the wrong order, to be head of horticulture for Garden Organic.
Still doing that now. It's been kind of a new discovery, this, in a little way. I've kind of gone, I don't know about you, we've moved away, haven't we? When I started gardening, I remember I'd been in a big tropical house on Brighton Park, and we'd be fumigating it with nicotine shreds and killing everything inside, and then walking around in it 10 minutes later.
Squash it.
Yeah, it's exactly like that. And we were very controlling. We were always edging stuff. I always remember parks, edging shears. We were always edging, weren't we, on hoeing and weeding.
I quite like that. I've got to be honest. I love edging.
Yeah, it's good. You know what? I bought my grass paths on my allotment. I bought a pair of flat edging shears to cut the grass. And my neighbour said to me, that's a bit labour intensive. And I was like, you don't know how much I'm enjoying this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's something about it. So what does that role entail?
Well, mainly I am an ambassador for them, to be fair. So my attitude to gardening now is, like most people, has become much more looser and freer, I suppose. I like my allotment to be very a mixed plot. There's a lot of flower on it. There's a lot of veg in it. I like things to be very diverse. I want to see, like, my balcony's full of hoverflies at the moment. That kind of gives me a kick, really. And I kind of, as we've sort of, how do you describe this? If you think about how prominent horticulture was, say, in the 60s when the parks were flying and everything, it's kind of been a little bit sidelined, I think. And I think environmental concerns, organic concerns, what we're eating, all these things gives horticulture a chance to lead from the front again. It kind of gives, it's a new opportunity for us to use our expertise in a new environment. And I, in a way, that's why I took the garden organic thing on. I like to garden organically. I want to see wildlife in my garden. I want to see everything in my garden. I want to see it to be as diverse as possible. But I also think it's a ball that's at our feet a little bit as horticulturalists.
Yeah, I think you've got a good point. I when I worked for Amateur Gardening, we had the archives of the very early issues, and we'd sometimes at coffee break flick through them, and there were these adverts of, you know, men smoking a pipe while spraying. Yeah. And you just think, how has the world changed? You know, poisoning himself on two levels from nicotine and insecticide, and they're promoting it. So we have moved on a fair way.
We have, very quickly, and very quickly as well. I remember my Percy Thrower. Have you read one of his books? It's like,
no,
it's like a one-man chemical war. It's DTT, it's every other sentence. And I just think, blimey, that kind of, you know, maybe this is about human beings. COVID, I look at it this way a bit as well. It's almost like nature's gone, whoa, hang on a minute, you know. It's like everybody take a breath. You know, and it's like, you know, when you're in your garden, I see you've been building your gabions recently, haven't you?
Oh, but yeah.
You're having a great old time. I was watching that. And just let's get in that little bubble for a little while and everybody take a breath, you know. I think that's where we are at the moment. And the gardeners understand that more than anybody else.
Yeah, I've got an elderly neighbour who's a fantastic gardener over the fence here. And he said to me at the beginning of all this, he said, Mother Nature's just pulling up our bootstraps. She's telling us we've got to watch out. So, I mean, I think it's only sensible that we look at what we're doing. And like you say, gardeners are in the position to influence that, aren't we? Especially people like you with the experience you've got.
Well, I think that, like, well, I know, obviously we don't know each other that well, Tamsin, and and we probably come from different kind of backgrounds, but I'll guarantee one thing, both of us, all we really want to do is be around and grow plants. And I think that's a very strong message. I think that being able to connect with nature like that, to have that kind of understanding, has got to be a positive contribution. And I'd like to see it implemented more in our communities and in our politics as well. I'd like to see it. I'd like to see us take the challenge on a bit more, I suppose. We're getting there, but, you know, there's lots of work to do.
And I'm quite concerned, you know, that once we get, whether we ever get back to normal, people are just going to get too busy. I'm already hearing people say, oh, well, yeah, you know, I'm a bit busy now to do the garden. Oh, it's tragic in a way.
Yeah, do we just revert to where we were? Well, that's the danger, isn't it? It's funny, I was watching the news this morning and the things that have been thrown up so long now, Boris has got this big obesity campaign. I couldn't help chuckling about that because we've been talking about it for a while. People have all rushed off to Spain. They've all got to come home again. I think people need to sort of think a little bit here about what's going on and less me, I suppose, is what I'm saying. And we're all selfish in our own little ways, but we can all contribute a bit more as well.
Absolutely. Now, I wanted to ask you, I mean, honestly, out of all the people I've interviewed, I'm sure my other guests won't mind, your CV is just cracking with all the things you've
so
done.
Kind.
What else could you possibly add to that? Is there something on your wish list?
Well, it's a good question, isn't it? Because, I'm 53, actually. I'm 53 on Wednesday, and I've been thinking about this. And a little bit of me now is thinking, you know what, in another 6 years, I could probably get out, you know. I've paid all this mortgage in London or whatever, and I could just buy a nice broken down property down in Devon or somewhere, or go back to Japan and retire and just grow stuff and fix the house up. But I doubt I'm ready for that. I am always itching, chomping at the bit for something. I think there's probably one big job left in me. I would like, to be honest with you, if I had the chance, to return to a botanic garden in some capacity, because at the end of the day, all I've done, for all the things I've done, I've never been happier when I'm surrounded by plant collections like you get in a botanic garden.
Yeah. And, I mean, because you've travelled abroad, you've got, like, an appreciation of all the different environments and different types of plants. But is moving to Japan out of the question? Or, I mean, would that be something you'd like to do?
I probably would. I might have a tough time persuading my wife. The thing about Japan is it's a man's world. Tamsin, you know, there's been no great sexual revolution in Japan, I'm afraid to say. Maybe it's starting now. So I think from her point of view, it might be a little bit of a different thing. I think she might go back there to retire. She'll never want to work there again. I know that. And, you know, she's come to London. She works with people from all over the world. It's a different game for her here. It's very much a salaryman's world in Japan. So I can kind of understand that, really. If I was going to go back to Japan, I'd go somewhere like Okinawa, in the south, and I'd pop myself on the edge of a forest and I'd run around till it was over, probably.
I mean, the thing is, though, with all the experience you've got and all the media coverage you get and all the people you know, I suppose you kind of feel that you have to use that to get your message out to kids, don't you? All your connections and all the things you've done in the past, you know, create these opportunities for you to get the word of gardening out.
Certainly, I feel like you're saying the garden organic thing. I very much feel, I'm sure you do as well, we're ambassadors, aren't we, for a wonderful subject. And doing the kids stuff particularly, it channeled that, you know. It kind of gave me a reason to be a part of it. And especially to working class kids, you know, it shows, you know, this, you can do this. You don't have to just stay here and work in the local supermarket. Not there's anything wrong with that. But it kind of, that message is quite important, that, it's possible. You can get your head down. You can come from somewhere that isn't that great. I come from a hard background and crack on and do stuff. And so particularly, but you know, rather than it being about me, I want it to be about the vehicle of growing plants and gardening, and because I just know, we know how healthy that is.
Yeah. And I suppose, do people from your past, you know, when you were a teenager, are they amazed by what you've done? Do they go, God, we never thought he'd turn out any good?
Pretty much to a man. Certainly my teachers. Yeah. If you'd had me in your classroom, you would not have forgotten me. I'll tell you that much.
It's funny because my English teacher, my mum met my English teacher, and I was useless at school, couldn't spell or anything. And she could not believe, she was in hysterical laughter when she'd heard I'd been editing magazines and written a book and everything. I thought, oh, great. So I think that's the thing that I love to tell kids, is that you might not have been any good at school, but if you find that thing you love, it doesn't matter. You'll get good at it, won't you?
Yeah, it's absolutely about finding your thing. And I kind of like, when you go into schools, is one thing disappoints me is how it's so academically governed, in a way that you've got to pass these hurdles, whereas you know as well as me, intellect comes in different guises. So like you, I had trouble, I just wasn't interested. I wanted to be outside when I was at school, but as soon as I gardening came into it, then the education tacked on the back of it, if you were like, and the two things blended, and I was away. And I think we need to look a little bit deeper into our kids to find that catalyst, if you like.
Oh, well, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you. I really do think everyone should know about what you've done and what you do.
That's very kind.
And you're a complete inspiration and not a Londoner, much to my
disappointment. Not a Londoner. Actually, I think it was the amateur gardener who interviewed me for The Plantsman. I forget the name of the girl, who called me a Mockney, if I remember rightly.
Brilliant. Oh, well, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you as well. Thank you.
Gosh, well, I'm sure you'll agree that Chris is having the most incredible career, and if I could switch my CV with anyone, it would be him. How wonderful to hear that gardening, when he was a young man, put him on the straight and narrow, and as a result, he shared his passion for horticulture with thousands of children. He really is simply inspiring. Well, until next time, enjoy your garden, get your kids out in the sunshine, and I will be back with another inspirational guest. Happy gardening.
Fresh from the Pod is presented by me, Tamsin Westhorpe, and produced by Candide in their plant-filled Bristol office. Candide is a free plant and gardening app with a helpful community of plant lovers, interesting articles and great tools like plant identification and garden tours. Ask a question in the app with the hashtag #FreshFromThePod and I'll choose my favourite to answer later in the series. And if you enjoyed Fresh From The Pod, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, share it on Reddit and talk about it with your friends. And don't forget to subscribe.